All right, good evening, everybody, and welcome to the latest in our series of lectures on Europe. This will be an unusual one because it's not about Brexit. At last. And I would ask that you respect the fact that Marco is our main speaker is in a delicate position because the European Commission has to be very careful about Brexit these days, since something called Article 50 has not yet been triggered. Therefore, nothing can happen, technically, until it does happen. So I would ask you not to raise questions about Brexit when it comes to the questions and answers. Now, you see here what we're trying to discuss this evening, incompatible trinities. The incompatible trinity originally was the justification for having the euro. You could not have all the incompatible things that particularly Bob Mundell said were at the heart of what was going wrong with having too much financial integration. And since then, incompatible trinities or inconsistent quartets have proliferated. Padua Schioppa had some, Danny Roderick had some, and now Marco Butti, our main speaker for the evening, also wants to have some discussion of incompatible trinities. Now, Marco, many of you will know, is the Director General of the Director General for Economic and Financial Affairs in the Commission. He's managed to hold this job for the best part of a decade, which is extraordinary, given what's been going on for the last...
It's extraordinary I'm still alive.
...last 10 years. Marco I've known a long time. He used to be in one of the Commissioner's cabinets, and then he gravitated upwards through DG ECFIN. He's a graduate of Oxford and Florence. I don't think we need to say much more because it's written down in the notes for the evening. Paul de Grauwe needs even less introduction. He's been a professor, John Paulson Chair at LSE now for how long? 6 years, is it?
5 years.
Before that, a well-known professor in Leuven. I'm told that he has tens of thousands of Twitter followers. Quite why nobody would want that, I don't know, but he does. And anyone that wants to put this on Twitter this evening can note that we have a special hashtag of #LSEEurope, which you can see on screen. Our third speaker is my colleague Marijke Kleine, who is an associate professor at the European Institute. She, unlike the rest of us on the panel, is a political scientist rather than an economist. So she's here to try to talk sense into us and also to realize that Marco is on thin ice as an economist talking political science incompatible trinities. So she will try to make sense of what we do. Marijke has worked on, in particular, things like informal governance at European level and how that's taking over from formal governance, but also the relationships between the member states and the Commission. So without further ado, I'd like you to give a warm welcome to our three panelists, and in particular to Marco Butti, who joins us here. The way we'll do this is that Marco's going to give an introduction of 20 or so minutes, then we'll have two comments from the other two panelists, and then we'll have a discussion initially orchestrated by me, but opening up to the floor. Marco.
Okay, thank you very much, and real pleasure indeed to be here. Thanks for organizing this, having invited me. I mean, you said already something that I have planned to say in the introduction, namely that the euro area is indeed built on Mundell Trinity that is well known since the Mundell-Fleming model of the 1960s. Actually, with a twist which made it even more relevant for the EU as a whole. Tommaso Padoa-Schioppa, you recalled, I mean, added the single market to that, and that became in his report of, I believe it was 1986, it became the inconsistent quartet, which, by the way, I open and close a bracket immediately. It is somewhat relevant also for the Brexit discussion here, because putting in the single market in the Trinity, so adding this dimension, clearly indicated that there is not only incompatibility between independent monetary policies and fixed exchange rate and free capital movement, but also put in the single market more generally, so the four freedoms which is okay, relevant for the discussion on Brexit and now, but I close the bracket immediately. Now, since we are at the LSE, I will see towards the end, I will bring in, and here I'm really on very, very thin ice, I will bring in Lord Dahrendorf, who was director of LSE back in the 1980s, where he, just after, actually, after he left the LSE and his war, he was warden at St. Anthony's in Oxford, published a paper which I think is, you are well, well advised to fish back because it's still very relevant, which is Square in the Circle, and I'll refer to that towards the end. Now, the outline of the talk, difficult transition, throughout the crisis and now, let's say, post-crisis environment. Try to put Europe a bit more into perspective, looking at what is happening more generally. Then go quickly to these incompatible treaties and you know, look at orientations for the way forward. Now, a difficult transition, not bother you with numbers. I think this summarizes a bit the difficulty in navigating through the crisis, you know, under, the, let's say, three big chapters. I mean, the first one is a low recovery and a lower potential growth. The fact that we still have problems with the banking system and a high debt legacy, let's say, of the Reiner-Rogoff type. So you see the bullets here, and I don't want to spend much time on this. We can come back in the discussion if you so wish. In terms of recovery, we have done in the euro area worse than the US. By the way, a relevant dimension here is domestic demand, not only GDP. If you look at GDP, we have recovered the pre-crisis level of 2008 back in 2015 for the euro area as a whole. On domestic demand, we have still not recovered the pre-crisis level. And in our forecast, that will may happen around 2018. Risk of debt deflation trap, I'll come back to that later on. I think there is not only the issue here of growth in cyclical terms, so in the short term, there is also a question of longer term growth, so decline in total factor productivity, which is worrying. Weak banks, I think there is clearly in a number of countries high non-performing loans, but there is, I think, agreement that the structural weakness are more pervasive than simply looking at the non-performing loans and are encapsulated in a low or entrenched profitability, which requires quite extensive restructuring of the banking system, and high debt legacy with a fiscal space, which in many countries is not very high, and with the deleveraging still ongoing in a number of sectors. Now, this is the, let's say, a snapshot in a very, let's say, first order on the economics and the financial, but there are broader tensions here which I think have to be taken into account to understand the current policy predicament in Europe. The broad tension had a decline in trust in Europe. I have to say here there is a decline in trust in Europe, but this is within the general trend of declining trust in institutions and including at the national level. And in fact, if you look at the Eurobarometer, you have this decline in trends and actually the decline in trends in many countries on national institutions is even steeper than you have it for Europe. Brussels bashing is a very well-known and well practiced sport in the past several years, which is which helps to regain popularity by politicians in the short term, but clearly leaves quite deep scars. And you know, rising populism, I do have to elaborate on this. Now, the question is that it is taken for granted, you have in this country or in the Brexit debate, that citizens, you know, they want less Europe. So it's regaining control. That's the name of the game. Less Brussels, new repatriate the competence. But is this really true? I think the answer is nuanced here, but it's not uniformly yes. And if you look at this is July July poll amongst a subset of countries. We don't have the UK here. And if you look at the let's call it new European public goods, creation of a European army, so a policy of defence, much more unified. Then you can see that there is a quite large support. Creation of a European finance minister, euro area finance minister, you can also reasonably good support. Clearly, I don't want to be too complacent here. It is clear that most likely citizens in Germany, which support the creation of European finance minister, may want something different from the European finance minister that you find in other countries. But it's a debate to be had, and the support I think is reasonably strong, and also the election of the EU president. And directly, also there you have quite a bit of support. I have not put here the popularity of the euro, which has been declining in a number of countries, but which remain actually pretty strong. So what this snapshot here tells us is that there is demand of something different. So we have to review the concept of European public goods and match demand and supply here, not necessarily a withdrawal within the national border. At least this is my simplified reading of this. Now, putting this into perspective, in this slide here, okay, I've used Keynes in our early beliefs. So what we had, what kind of reading did we have 2 decades ago? You know, just go back to what you thought 20 years ago. And at least these were, if I remember well, my early beliefs, 20 years ago. There was a discussion already on globalization. And when I come to Ralph Dahrendorf, by the way, it is precisely this 20 years ago. So, but the issue was more concerned about race to the bottom, with capital eroding the generosity of the welfare state and the tax base, etc. So the concern was with capital, not so much with labor. And now what you see is the actual tensions, if anything, come much more from the labor side than from the capital side. Second was the very low skilled, so those at the bottom of the productivity scale were priced out of the market, and the working poor in the US or the high unemployment in the EU, both by globalization and technological progress. What we did not realize at the time is that the impact of the two, of the combined effect of globalization and the skill-biased technological progress, has actually affected the median income, not only the very bottom of the productivity scale. And actually, if you look at some literature on this, some analysis recently, you have the view that possibly those doing very manual work at the bottom end of the productivity scale. They are possibly more, let's say, protected by the system than those just above, which are, you know, the, let's say, undifferentiated white collars, which may have been impacted by the globalization and technological progress much more than those at the very bottom. And what I'm expecting, for instance, thinking about Europe, is that the next wave of restructuring is likely to take place in the banking sector, and the and there one has to see how the welfare system that we have actually cater for this type of worker, which in many countries were actually amongst the privileged ones only a little while ago. And the difference between those at the very bottom of the productivity scale and those above, this let's say displaced white collar, is that the latter are not only they are the median income, but also the median voter. So there is a clear you know, political relevance to this much more than those at the bottom end. We had faith in multilateral solutions, including including Europe. That has you know, faded, and we'll have to see what happens now looking forward with a new U.S. Administration. The fourth point here is that we thought that sharing sovereignty would bring naturally, in particular, let's say, sharing monetary sovereignty here would bring naturally convergence of social preferences and mutual trust, and actually this has not happened. You know? So naively we thought that, but the reason, I think, in my assessment, at least they have written something on this that you can find on the web, is that what happened actually in the first 10 years of economic and monetary union, when we were on the, you know, in benign times, under the surface, divergence took place at the structural level. If you look at the proportion between tradables and non-tradables, specialization within the euro area, you see Germany and other, let's say, core countries having shifted much more in terms of the towards tradable goods, other becoming much more intensive in non-tradables. And since it had, this has lasted actually 10 years, so a long time, this has also affected the social preferences of the countries. So when the crisis arrived, it brought to the surface these underlying divergences, which were actually, you know, fueled during the first 10 years. And the final point is that we thought, okay, Europe has extensive, very generous welfare state, welfare systems, which would protect largely from inequality, maybe adverse to growth, but, you know, protecting on the inequality side. And we have seen that the perception now is this is actually not the case. In part, there is an element of reality. In other part, is perception. But perception is very important if one thinks about the political landscape. So, what happens now? I think you to put this into perspective. I come to this. Inconsistent trinities, and there has been a proliferation. I have contributed myself also to add the new trinities. Some these are, I think, more solid in terms of the interpretation. Let's say you can choose the two sides of the two corners of the triangle, not the rest in any combination. Others, especially this one with the let's say, with the more political institutional dimension, I think this is, let's say, less strict in terms of incompatible trinities. I'll say this is the first one, so political integration. Actually, you can read this one clockwise if you start from the bottom. Basically, what we had before the Single European Act, so the Single Act is the one that launched the project, the 1992 project of completing the single market in Europe, we were in the combination of the two bottom corners. So we had there we had nation-state institutions, dominating the policy game in the EU, traditional democratic processes with legitimacy coming actually bottom up from the from member states. Now, with Maastricht. So this is the situation, let's say, around the mid-1980s. With Maastricht, we went clockwise, and we shifted with the traditional democratic processes and political, deeper political integration. And here we had, let's say, a move towards a more, let's say, federalist approach. I think more accountable, the spreading of the extension of the majority voting in decision making. So this was what and the process towards the single currency. Now, come the crisis, so we move from the 1990s to the 2000s, so end of the 2000s, we moved, yet we did another step, and we combined actually the political integration with the creation of the European Stability Mechanism, the move towards banking union, still incomplete, but on which we are working now, you know, capital markets unions, other institutions related to financial integration, but very much based on intergovernmental method of. So there, the combination has been deep and deeper, you know, political integration with nation-state institutions. Now, what is the next step? I think the next step it's still not clear where we are going to go, but I think what would be, in my view, the consistent step is to go to come more towards something which has deep political integration and, you know, more traditional democratic processes, going back to more community method, and the legitimacy based not only on national institutions but also on the European level institutions. So this is the, let's say, the first step in the first inconsistent trinity, which is more the political and institutional one. So the second one is on economic and social viability. This is not euro area specific, is more for the, let's say, advanced economies more generally. And here you can, I'm not going to explain this, you can follow it yourself, is rather self-evident. So basically, if you have low potential growth, looking forward, if you want to have sustainable, say here, for sufficiently generous welfare models, then it is very difficult to keep the public finances under control. At the same time, if you want sound fiscal policies, so debt and deficit under control, and also a welfare state which is protects and responds to the demands of protection, then you cannot afford to grow to have low potential growth looking forward. So this is the second element I think in the picture. How do you solve this? I think clearly the it seems to me the best way is to combine sound fiscal policy looking forward with sustainable and sufficiently generous welfare system. And that implies that one does something about the low potential growth on the economies. The third inconsistent treaty, it is specifically on a Eurozone one. And here, what you can have is that, that's what we are actually living nowadays, is that if you have inflation persistently below target, so the target of the ECB being around, let's say, 2%, or just below, but close to 2%. It is very difficult for countries which are more vulnerable and which have, at the same time, to regain competitiveness and to lower the debt burden to do so. Because, I mean, it is clear that if you have basically zero, for illustration purposes, if you just take zero inflation, then if you have to, if you want to keep your debt under control, then you will want to have a reasonably high inflation. But if at the same time you have to regain competitiveness, you will have to have actually negative inflation. So the two elements here conflict in a quite sharp manner. The way you solve the inconsistent trinity, hopefully, would be to have to move back to levels of inflation which are consistent with the price stability as defined by the ECB. Some would even go further and advocate an increase in the target. I would not do so, but that would be get to 2%. I think would allow to lessen, let's say, the tensions between the sustainability of a high debt and the competitive gains, especially in vulnerable economies. So, what if you solve the three triangles for the, let's say, the good corner? Then I think you come to something that is looks like it, at least in my view. The first one is that you would need, let's say, reforms to boost potential growth and provide the resources for the welfare state looking forward. I think a more balanced policy mix, not leaving all the responsibility to boost inflation to the ECB, but having a more supportive fiscal policy. And then, referring to the very first trinity, the strengthening of the EU dimension in the policy making. So, gaining the legitimacy not only based in nation-state institutions, but also institutions at the EU level. Now, looking forward, what are the new policy priorities? If you put all this together, I will see three main chapters. One is we need structural reforms to boost potential growth, but this is, let's say, structural reforms. I've dubbed here 2.0 because, I mean, the kind of reforms that we have done so far in the during the crisis, they have been at least also perceived as being of the punitive side and associated, associated to loss of income and hardship. So bringing in the inclusiveness element in the structural reforms. A more balanced policy mix, I mentioned it before, and I think we have to rethink the architecture of EMU, I think here, respond to the request of new European public goods, rebuilding trust to complete EMU, and also, let me not elaborate on vertical coherence here, but the element of rebuilding a shared project. Now, very difficult to do so. I mean, the slides are going to be distributed, so you can find it later here. But look, we are faced with quite deep differences within the EU and within the euro area. Here, I have summarized differences in economic and in differences in the institutional side. No prize for you for guessing who are the countries behind each color. Here, but clearly there is something that is more the emphasis on the short-term or demand and others who think about more, let's say, the long-term rules, etc. So we have to bridge, I think, these different sensitivities, which, as I said, are pretty deep and based actually on what I indicated before, which is this divergence of, let's say, social preferences which have taken place in the first 10 years of EMU. Now, bridging these differences is necessary to avoid the curse of the ultima ratio. What is the curse of the ultima ratio? Is that you decide and you make important decisions only when you are staring into the abyss. So when you are short against the world, you have no other choice. Then you find all of a sudden a lot of political courage and make decisions, otherwise you don't. Now, not going to go through this, but I have applied this the steps of the ultima ratio to the euro area crisis. I invite you to do the same exercise for the current migration crisis. You will see that the steps are exactly the same. So this is, it captures, it seems to me, some element of this decision making, deep features in the political process, I would say at the EU level, but probably not only. And the only difference here is that for migration, for the euro area crisis, we have gone through the stages, all the stages. From migration, we are probably around this stage here. If you take this logic here and we do not overcome that, then you have to wait for the situation to get worse before it gets better. So I hope we can overcome the curse of the ultima ratio, because this is clearly a problem. Now, I come to Dahrendorf. This is my final slide. And it is, okay, Squaring the Circle of Ralph Dahrendorf. This was published exactly 20 years ago, 1995. There are several papers. It was a little book published in Italian, actually, for the first time, called Exactly Square in the Circle. He wrote this after the fall of the Berlin Wall and the rise of China and the Asian economy. So basically, his point is that it's difficult to combine economic growth, social cohesion, and democratic liberty. And I combine this with Roderick 2000, and you mentioned the TIN, the incompatible triangle on globalizations, which is very difficult to find, to combine together democratic liberty, globalization, and a national self-determination. So this is the Roderick, Danny Roderick conundrum. Now, putting the two together, what you can see is that, okay, they have one thing in common, which is the democratic liberty. So this is the bottom of Dahrendorf triangle and the top of Roderick triangle. Now, if one assumes, and maybe it's a big assumption, we can discuss that, that globalization and economic growth go hand in hand, then you are left with two casualties. And the casualties are social cohesion and national self-determination. So what comes out of this, looking at the two incompatible trinities of Roderick and Dahrendorf together. Now, globalization is now much discussed, and you have two views within Europe on globalization. How is globalization perceived? The two views are the following, and here is A and B. One is that Europe is actually regional globalization. So we do what globalization does in the worldwide, we do it in Europe. So in a sense, for those who perceive in a negative way the dangers of globalization, they finger point Europe for being, okay, you have brought it into, home, at home. So, and you blame Brussels and European institutions for all the, all the negative implications of globalization. So this is the first view. The second view is that Europe is actually, could be the joint response to the globalization threats. And this has, the more positive connotation. Now, the issue here then is that how, in the present policy and political debate, we make two, so the second one, joint response to globalization, as the one, as the, as the response to the current threats. So how do you do that? And that is my final slide. And it is the following, this one. Now, globalization rightly or wrongly, together with skill-biased technological progress, is identified as having negative implications for distributional, for income wealth distribution, and also responsible for the stagnation of let's say median income. Hmm? So we have to tackle the distributional issue head on. Now, if you think about where distributional distributional threats or developments come, you identify these three dimensions. Huh? The three dimensions are you create inequality in the pre-market. So here is the whole issue of endowment, how you enter into the market in the first place. The second one is the second dimension is the market, actually. So is the liberalization, the integration of markets. And the third one is the correction that the welfare state tax and benefit system bring to the distribution of income, which result from market forces. So these are the three dimensions where the distributional elements come in. Now, if you look at the competencies of the EU now, the competence is essentially this. The EU has virtually very, very, very little competence in the pre-market phase and very little competencies in the post-market phase. We have strong competencies in integrating markets, so in the second dimension. Whilst the member states, they have strong competencies in the pre- and the post-market. But if you think about the populist discussion and debate now, the populists, they intervene also in the first and the third dimension, but they essentially intervene in the second dimension. So if you leave the competence as they are now, you pitch populist forces directly against the EU, because we operate in the same space. Hmm? So it is not by chance that you have when you have a populist forces throughout Europe, they finger point for different reasons, maybe opposite reasons, but they finger point Brussels and the EU as being the main adversary, because we operate in the same dimension. It is allegation of harsh phase of Europe, integrating the markets, competition policy, state aid, etc. This is, I think, politically and institutionally not a sustainable equilibrium. So I think a sustainable equilibrium here, I think, would be to have, and this is the dotted broken lines here, to have to reconcile, I think, the three dimensions and to have European responsibilities also at the pre-market phase and at the post-market phase. It does not imply, an excessive centralization of competencies, but we one has to discuss what is in the principle of subsidiarity, what is best done at the central level versus the decentralized one. But the current equilibrium is not a sustainable one. So I think when we come to the look into the future, we are working currently on the white paper that is going to be discussed by leaders in March 2017 at the occasion of the 60th anniversary of the signing of the Treaty of Rome, so the creation of what used to be the Le Marché Commun at the time. I think this element here will have to keep to be kept in mind, because the present system I think is vertically not sustainable, and that's what vertical integration that I had in the previous graph meant.
Thank you, Marco.
Thank you.
I should have mentioned at the beginning that Marco, throughout his career, has managed to keep writing articles, books, and so on. I've even featured it, a chapter in one of the books he edited. And he's demonstrated again this evening that he has distinct academic bent. How he does it with all the other demands on his time, I have no idea. Paul, give us your reaction.
Hey, thank you very much. Let me first say how happy I am to be here, despite the miserable weather. I'm also very happy to be able to discuss this presentation that Marco did, and also this paper that he wrote, preliminary, which dealt with impossible trinities. There's, of course, a danger of diarrhea of trinities that we should keep in mind. But this being said, I think it's a good way to organize one's ideas. What I want to do is the following. I want to argue that many of these impossibilities in these triangles arise from the nature of governance in the EU that, it seems to me, is not adapted to modern capitalism. You hinted at it at the end, right? Basically saying that our governance structure is not sustainable, but that is also going to be my point. And I will develop that point under two headings. One has to do with basically the Eurozone, and the other one has to do with free trade and globalization. So let me start off in the following way. We are all believers here in the wonders of a free market system and capitalism, right? It's a great system, but it's also a very unstable system, full of volatility, creating booms and busts, making us feel happy during the boom, even euphoric and miserable, many people, during the bust. And this is what capitalism is about, right? It's very unstable. And it seems to me that, and now I'm focusing on the Eurozone, right? That the way we govern that monetary union is just not adapted to that feature. Because what we have done essentially in the Eurozone is to take away most of the stabilizing functions of the nation states, right? That we built in the past precisely to deal with the instability of capitalism. We took it away from nation states without creating something above that would take over and stabilize the system as a whole. And this has been very visible when the financial crisis erupted, that we were unable to take over or to organize a stabilizing feature. All that we heard from Brussels, and you will allow me that I'm doing some Brussels bashing, but this is not really focused towards the European Commission, but the whole institutional structure, right? And I'm going to use the term Brussels to indicate to that. All we heard is that, well, in order to stabilize the system, what you have to do is to have sustainable fiscal policies, and a central bank that keeps inflation at close to 2%, and that's it. Then you stabilize the system. But clearly we learned from the crisis that this is not sufficient. The instability of the system is of such a nature that this will not do, and it did not do, right? So we have a problem here that we have created a system that is not fit to deal with this problem, especially within the context of the Eurozone. And as a result, here nation states are incapable of doing what they are supposed to do, that is to protect citizens from these wild movements that are generated in a capitalistic system. And this has turned out to be extremely difficult, and that undermines the legitimacy of national governments, because people expect that national governments do that. And when you take this away, these national governments lose legitimacy. And we have to deal with that, right? Either this will mean that we deconstruct the Eurozone and give these responsibilities back to the nation states, or that we create the necessary institutions at the European level that are capable of taking over the stabilizing function that national governments have lost. That's the big dilemma, the choice that we will face, and I'm not so sure we will disagree that much on this, but I'm curious to know whether you would agree with that or not. Let me turn to the second point that I want to make here. Again, arguing that the present institutional structure of Europe is not fit to deal with major problems that we face in a free market system, and that has to do with free trade and globalization. Right? Again, free trade, I've always been in favor of free trade. This has been a great dynamics to create material welfare and to lift hundreds of millions of people in the world from abject poverty. But as we also know, it creates losers, I don't have to tell you. And we economists have always said, well, that's not really a problem. We will compensate the losers. And since free trade creates excess material welfare, right, it's a positive game, not a zero-sum game, there is enough material welfare that is created that can be used to compensate the losers, right? But political scientists are certainly aware that this is very hard to organize. And this has turned out to be the case. And here I come to my view about European institutions. They have not helped. They have probably made life even more difficult and made it more difficult to compensate the losers for two reasons. One has been the focus that has been given or pushed towards structural reforms, right? We hear this narrative from Brussels, quote unquote, for many years that we have to have structural reforms, introduce flexibility. But here we are, globalization is all about major changes in production structures and all that. And then trying to introduce structural reforms is typically going to mean that we hit the losers twice, because they are hit by globalization, right? Those who lose their jobs or see their income decline, and then they are told that they should be more flexible and they should subject themselves to structural reforms, which means, among other things, if you are unemployed, well, your unemployment benefits will be reduced. The probability that you lose your job will be increased because job protection is bad, is rigid, and nobody wants to be rigid. And as a result, we have created a paradigm and applied it also that hits essentially those who are most affected by globalization. No wonder that they revolt and say, we don't want this kind of Europe, right? Because Europe is perceived then to be the instrument for further disruptive kind of globalization. At least that's the way these people perceive this. So that's one reason, I think, excessive focus on structural reforms and flexibility, and also during or since the crisis, excessive austerity, which has created a situation where, again, the losers of globalization have been hit twice, because the soft part of spending, in particular social security, has been hit precisely at the time that we should have made it easier for people that are losing from globalization to be compensated. So here we are. We face extremely difficult challenges, but Europe doesn't seem to have the institutions today to deal with that in a proper way. I've argued that this is the case in the Eurozone, but for reasons of stabilization, I think it's also there as a mechanism to deal with globalization, and we have not been able to organize compensation schemes that will make it possible for those who are hit by globalization to feel better. And then we should not be surprised that these people reject the whole system. Let me conclude by just a note on sound fiscal policy and growth. This was one of the triangles, right? Impossible trinities. One of the things that I think we have done on ourselves is that is to introduce a conflict here between fiscal policy and potential growth. We have introduced with the fiscal compact this requirement in the Eurozone to maintain budget balance over the business cycle, which means that countries or governments are not allowed to issue debt to finance public investment. They should finance public investment by current incomes, right? And this has been introduced, probably the idea does not come from Brussels. I think the idea comes more from another capital city that starts with a B. The idea, I think, has been very pernicious and continues to be very pernicious, because it prevents governments to do public investments, right? If you tell politicians that they should finance public investments today by current income of today, which means today's taxpayers should pay the full cost of public investment, while the benefits will be to a large extent for future taxpayers and voters, we should not be surprised that politicians are not very much attracted by this kind of incentive scheme, and as a result, they will not do much public investment. So we should really get away from this, and that is something we have that we could change, right, and make one of these triangles less constraining than they are today. I think I should stop here.
Okay, thanks. I suspect that Marine Le Pen will be listening to Paul, setting out her policies. And no doubt the capital he's referring to
is... You listen to me too, right?
No doubt the capital you're talking about is Brasilia. Marijke.
Thanks also for the invitation and the opportunity to react. Thanks for your talk. I must admit that initially I was a little bit confused by the framing, because you open up with sort of a sociological review of the state of the European Union. You're reviewing the blame game, the state of Euroscepticism, rising populism, and so on and so forth. And the debate right now, that was, of course, incredibly vibrant after Brexit, but also the Trump vote, there's been a lot of discussion about what causes this rising economic populism. And much of this debate points to distribution and redistribution, and yet the distribution is something that you mention at the very end of the talk, and the rest of the talk, are the first slides are very much about growth, and I was left puzzled by what growth. Of course, there's a link, but it's not an immediate link between necessarily growth and or low growth and sort of the rise in populism. So therefore, I found your very last slide actually the most helpful and the clearest slide that represents your argument. And yet, I'm still, of course, I have to be skeptical. I'm a political scientist, or I'm an academic, so I'm still skeptical about it to some extent. So to sum up your argument here, the EU is to some extent wrongfully blamed for creating inequality, right? It is wrongfully because inequality is sort of a product of these various stages, and yet sort of the EU sort of portion in it is really not as as important, I would say, than the responsibility that the nation states carry for inequality. But you say the EU is still blamed. Politicians have an incentive to blame the EU for all kinds of reasons, and the system is simply unsustainable this particular way. Your conclusion is that the EU has to change. So I have two questions about sort of this line of argument and conclusion. The first question would be, is this really the right conclusion to draw? Should we just really focus on the European Union? And the second would be, would the institutional reforms that you suggest, would they actually be, would they address the problem? Would they make the EU more sustainable? And that sort of echoes to some extent with what Paul also just said. So regarding the first question is, shouldn't the reform actually be pursued at the national level rather than the EU level, right? I admit this. It's a mean question because you're an EU official, and you cannot just change the national institutions like this. So let's just go along and think about what can be done at the EU level. But I think still, though, that much of the crisis that we're observing, and I think you would basically agree here, that really at the core of the crisis of not only the economic and inequality crisis, but the crisis of populism, the roots of all of this lie in problems at the national level and not necessarily the EU level. And so the question, I think, has to be posed, why then the EU level should be the one to change. So the second one question would be, would those reforms ever be successful? Can the EU ever address intra-societal inequality, if not also inter-societal inequality, in order really to address the roots of the problem that you mentioned at the very beginning about rising populism and pretty much the unsustainability of the system, not only for economic grounds, but for economic reasons, but especially for political reasons. So first, most of my doubts have to do with preferences. The first one would be, is there in any way any appetite for any kind of redistribution that is in any way done at the EU level? I mean, we see in the case of the southern states, where the Troika, of course, has a lot of say on how exactly the national welfare states work, that this is an incredibly contentious issue. And I'm not entirely sure if this is actually an issue that would work on a broader scale, not just between in those particular cases, Just broadly across, let's say, at least the Eurozone member states in one way or the other, given already very different views on austerity, as I just mentioned, but also I think since many of the problems, and if you really look at sort of the losers of globalization and also the people who fall for populism, to a large extent they can be called losers of globalization, but to another extent they're also losers of automatization, right, of technological, let's call it progress, which is something that the educational systems of the various countries simply don't really address or have not addressed yet. So can the EU level in any kind or in any way really address this, if this is at the root of the problem of populism and therefore the political unsustainability of the system? The second is whether or not the preferences that governments have for blaming the European Union will ever go away, even if we address the problem. So there's some research in political science, especially by colleagues from in the European Institute, that really what makes the difference is sort of the breakup of an elite consensus and the presence of a populist party. So once you have a populist party, the EU will ever always be blamed, no matter for what, right? And the other elite parties, established parties, they will answer to this and sort of buy into the same rhetoric. And this holding the level of sort of popular support for the European Union constant. So if you already have a populist party with some clout, it is very, very difficult to, so to say, put the genie back into the bottle. And then the question, of course, arises whether or not institutional reforms at the EU level, sort of streamlining EU policy, you mentioned vertical coherence. To me, it sounds like more centralization, more majority voting. To what extent this is actually helpful or counterproductive, right? Because QMV, majority voting, more than anything, allows governments to point their finger at Brussels and blame them for all kinds of things, because it seems very logical that without a veto, bad things could not be prevented. The third sort of question, sort of doubt that I have, is that we're not only talking about a rise in populism, but let's say a rise in the tide of populism. We also talk about a change in the cleavages in national discourses. So where we used to have a left-right discourse and debate, we now have a globalist, anti-globalist debate that is incredibly polarized. It's not just that you sort of have a normal distribution of preferences, you actually have sort of one bump here and one bump there, and just very, very different preferences and also very different debates, as we can see, especially in the US, but I think the United Kingdom is also going this way. So this raises the question to what extent, under those circumstances, we can still talk or hope for any political sustainability or even legitimacy at all, if there is always a substantial minority, a very substantial minority, that wants exactly the opposite of what you're doing in terms of policy, in terms of institutional reform, and is pretty sizable in terms of size. So is there any kind of globalist or international institution in any case sustainable given a set of polarized preferences or a polarized distribution of preferences with anti-globalism on the one end and globalism on the other hand. So those would be sort of the questions that I raise. And nevertheless, hopefully not take anything away from your talk, which sort of very nicely sharpened the issues and the dilemmas that European policymakers face today. And I'm just very glad that I'm not a policymaker, just in the position to criticize them. Thanks. Thanks.
Now, Marco, I know you'd love to reply immediately, but we have an audience. So I would like to go first to the audience. I'll also forget my own questions at this point and go straight to taking three questions from the audience. Who would like to start? Okay, over here and then down here. Just say who you are and try to be succinct.
Thank you for that. Seems to me it's obvious.
That's who you are.
Oh, I'm just a member of the public. I work in insurance, IT and insurance. The other triangle that I would have highlighted that you don't seem to have mentioned directly is that of enlargement, sovereignty, and stability. It seems to me you could easily say no enlargement or fear of further enlargement, no Brexit. How would you respond to that?
Okay, question here.
Martin Wheel from the Centre for Macroeconomics. This is perhaps more an observation. It would seem to me that for the EU to get involved in a detailed way in welfare systems at a time when they're coming under increasing pressure because of an ageing population and at a time when many countries have budgetary difficulties in any case would simply be increasing the opportunities for populists to point fingers at the EU. When governments cut welfare benefits, then regards that as very unsatisfactory. If the EU is involved in doing it, then there will be a very large wall of unfavorable opinion, and it will make the problems worse at least that much.
Okay, pass the microphone to John.
Yes, John Peter, an economist. I think I have a similar, slightly related question on this post-market welfare systems. I mean, I interpret that as meaning what you really think may be necessary is, in effect, to move from a monetary union to a transfer union. And I think that would recreate the stabilizing function that Paul de Grauw mentioned. But anybody who goes to this capital beginning with B will know that the people of that country are very allergic to any suggestion that there should be transfers in the monetary union. How do you solve that problem?
Okay, we'll take answers to these three questions, a minute or so each, starting with Marijke, maybe. Anything that you want to pick up?
No.
Okay.
Paul? Why not? I think they were mostly addressed to Marco.
Okay, thank you very much. That's nice. Okay. Can I say something about the previous comments also, very quickly?
Very quickly.
No, very quickly. It seems to me that you have chosen two nice discussions because you have opposite views. If I go down to what you now you're saying, no, it's not true.
So you don't have to say anything then.
No. It is, no, the fact that, Marijke sees the response, mainly the response to the challenges that we are facing in response at the national level, and then you ask the question whether the reform should not be there, and Paul actually, if I interpret well what you say and what you have written, you see the responsibility at the supranational level also, so not only at the national level. Now. Okay, it seems to me that we are facing clearly in very deep challenges, but one has to agree here of, in the globalization, but also in the, technological, sharpening contradictions here, whether the national level is the right level applying subsidiarity principles, to engage in the response. I mean, my response would not be that you can deal with these matters in, let's say, taking the national dimension as being the right one. Obviously, we have to avoid to give the wrong answers at the European level, but that seems to me the level that is necessary for many of these challenges to tackle in earnest. I mean, if I think about the future of the G20 with the G7, G20 in particular, what is going to happen on many of these challenges? We have not mentioned, climate change or other things, which actually you have done it when you've been writing about globalization. This is very difficult to believe that one can do that by taking countries on their own. Now, it is true that there is a tendency, which is probably an inescapable one, to blame Brussels for many. And it is possible that in the new polarized world, that will be the natural bashing element. I think this is. I try to capture this in my final graph there. And since we operate in the liberalization of markets and try to keep markets and countries open, I mean, you are straight into conflict. That's why I think we should. We should try to see what is the right degree of involvement in the other two dimensions. Martin's point, I see the danger. I mean, it is clear. I would not advocate EU involvement in the minutiae of the reforms of the welfare and tax and benefit systems at the national level. But there is, I think, the right level that one could consider and possibly also coming to a combination of this whilst when we are planning to deepen economic and monetary union. I mean, one of the ideas put forward in the so-called Five Presidents Report about 2 years ago was to envisage for the Eurozone a top-up of the, let's say, unemployment benefit system as a way also to have a better risk sharing and to absorb asymmetric shocks. I think this does not impinge on the reforms that one may want to do at the national level, but clearly indicates that there is a more coherent articulation between what you do at the national level and what you do at the supranational level, EU level, on the redistribution side. I think I am of the generation of European international officials which, going back to Richard Musgrave, functions of government, so the stabilization, the redistribution, and the allocation, we never looked at the middle one. So, because we thought that this would pertain to national preferences, I think this is not sustainable in the future, and somehow the right way, avoiding the pitfalls, one has to consider or to factor in, including on the structural reform side, Paul criticized the inclusiveness element, precisely to move away from the kind of structural reforms that we have seen seen in the past. I mean, at the same time, I do not think that the issue of flexibility can be put aside completely. I mean, you are in a single currency, you need the possibility to adapt to shocks, so flexible markets have to be there, including on the labor market, and there is a way, however, to combine we have to look at the flexibility model. There are ways to combine attention to redistribution with flexible markets. Just one point on the figures. Social spending has not gone down during the crisis. look, if you look at what has happened, actually, he has, okay.
Because there's an endogenous component, right?
No, it is it is true because of the pressure on unemployment benefits and social spending. But one, I mean, if you look at the over the past 8 years, or, you know, 8-9 years, I mean, social spending in Europe has gone down to, you know, almost 2 points in percent of GDP. And what has gone down too, it is public investment. On this, one can argue, what is the reason for public investment to go down? You attribute to the rules and to the pressure of the for the implementation of the rules. I think, and the intertemporal element of the benefits may have they have a role here. My political reading of this is that you have most likely behind public investment less strong vested constituencies, vested interests than you have vis-à-vis other types of. You know, budgetary
let me take another round of questions, Mark.
Yeah.
And come back to it. Lorenzo was first. There was somebody over here once who posed a question. So let's go there first. Yeah. See. Yeah.
Thanks. Hi, I'm Sebastian. I'm a PhD student in the European Institute. Thanks very much for your talk. Mr. Buti, in your third trilemma, the Eurozone one, which I assume is probably very important for you also professionally, you pitted low inflation against high debt burdens and competitiveness, and you seem to suggest that the solution to solve the trilemma is to get to higher levels of inflation, and I was wondering how, to some extent, how you want to get there when you say that Either you were saying that the ECB should do more, but then nobody can tell the ECB what to do. And on the other hand, maybe to just pick up on the point that you raised, also we shouldn't do much about the fiscal rules, it seemed, or you seem to imply. So I'm really wondering how you want to get to that world, to that ideal world that you seem to suggest.
And then on the front here. And I notice that no woman have asked a question yet. We'll be in trouble with LSE, if you don't.
Okay. Lorenzo Codogno, European Institute. First of all, thank you very much for the very nice, you know, fascinating discussion. My taking is that the view of Marco and the view of Paul are very much complementary to some extent, okay? And if I can draw a conclusion, my conclusion is that Europe either has to move ahead, further integrate, and therefore build up, welfare institutions and so forth, or has to move back and there give power again to national states and the possibility to basically introduce, you know, welfare to provide this kind of buffer which was missing during the crisis. But then you have another dimension, which is the political economy dimension, which have actually showed a strong movement away from community institutions towards intergovernmental institutions. And when you have a situation which is very much unbalanced, and it's the same capital starting with a B as a kind of veto power on decisions in Europe, it's kind of difficult to move ahead. It is also difficult to move back. So how are you doing?
All right. Any woman willing to ask a question? Just here, please.
It just, if it is only for the statistics, I arrived late, so my question would only have something to do with the last graph. I noticed that populist forces are on the side of nation states, but how could we...
It doesn't have. On the other side.
Okay, so it is
not overinterpreted.
But what is in this box actually? Because I'm coming from a political psychology perspective, so I'm looking at how people talk. Is it something that, could be decomposed in a way? So how do you understand the populist forces?
Okay, I'll take two very quick questions if you could. Pasquale and Angelo.
Actually, just following up, because it may sound slightly...
Tell us who you are.
I'm Angelo Martelli, PhD student at the European Institute as well. It may sound slightly provocative, but it's the third presentation in a month from a policymaker at the EU level, where I see the populist forces box coming in the very last slide or the very last two slides. So in a way, it sounds to me a bit like what we have been doing with Brussels, scapegoating Brussels, and in a way scapegoating right now capitalism and globalization. In actually one of your points in the presentation was we have to be careful looking at the future because automation would probably affect also white collar jobs. So aren't we actually running the risk to tackle problems that belong to the 90s, 2000s in a way, because globalization is actually slowed down and automation, job polarization is actually a phenomenon of the early 2000s. So we are now seeing the effects just because the crisis exacerbated this, but we are actually tackling something of the past and not actually be ready for the future in a way.
Very quickly, please.
Pasquale Foresti from the LSE European Institute. And very briefly, I want to pick up on the point about reforming the policy mix. Because in the broader perspective of the trilemma, there are different views in this, like having more fiscal flexibility, less flexibility when we put into the picture financial stability. So I would like briefly to know what is your understanding, what would be the policy mix reform according to you, like the most useful or proficient one.
Okay, thanks so much. Marco, I'm going to add one more basic question. It's the kind of elephant in the room, not the one we're used to in this country. Was EMU a mistake? Now, Marco or Paul, do you want to say anything first? And I'll give the last word to Marco.
Well, last question, but how much time do you give me? I can just say, yes, it's a mistake. It was a mistake.
Right, well, that point has been...
That's clearly. So you didn't need much time.
Marijke?
We'd like to elaborate, but...
you'd like to elaborate, but that is your conclusion.
Marijke?
That is my conclusion, yeah.
I concur.
There you are.
He's the expert.
Marco, I hand back to you too.
Okay. On the last point, I don't agree. it doesn't come as a surprise, obviously. Now, let me say that let me elaborate slightly on this point here. What we did not do, and I think the main mistakes that we made in the process of monetary integration in EMU, I do not think happened during the crisis. They happened, and this is underlined a bit my discussion there, they happened before the crisis. And so basically what we had during the benign time during the crisis, before the crisis, we had this, on the one hand, we had this reform anesthesia. So here I do not agree with Paul. He would say that he does not agree with his view on the role of structural reforms. But if you take the ultima ratio logic that I had before. The ultima ratio logic applies not only on decision making at the European level, and I illustrated with the sovereign debt crisis and with the migration crisis, it happens also with reforms at the national level. And on structural reforms, you have basically two views. One view is that is the Keynesian one. Okay, do reforms when the cake is expanding. So you can compensate the losers with all the problems related to the actual compensation, beside the theoretical one. The other view is the moral hazard view, which is typically of Germany, which says, okay, unless politicians are really shoulder against the wall, reforms do not happen. Now, the first 10 years of EMU,
I think then they get dictators at some point.
No, then possibly they get dictators. One has to discuss that. They have time to elaborate on your answer. I don't have time to elaborate on this one either. But basically, the first 10 years of EMU, I think, showed lack of enlightenment. So it is true that I agree that the crisis was not a fiscal one. We agree with the reading of Paul. But the lack of creating sufficient buffers before the crisis, so have to have more room for maneuver when the crisis came, actually is one of the reasons why the fiscal response was and the room for maneuver was not there when it was most needed. And at the same time, I think we were left with structures of the economy which diverged in the essence, and the structural reform did not take place during the period of anesthesia of the first 10 years. So I think one could have done things differently and been better in a better shape than we are now. But I think the problems came from the initial, for those benign period. I think the counterfactual here is very difficult to argue. Could national central banks, dispersed national central banks, in the face of the crisis, have reacted in a more effective way than the ECB did? I think there is a question mark on that. I personally think that it is difficult to believe that they would have done that without leading to risk of disruption of the internal market even more than what we have observed so far. So I think the answer is the institutional one, which I believe also. Is that I think it was not a mistake what we had to do now, and we have the problems that we are facing right now. I think we'll have to complete the architecture in a way that is a viable and sustainable one. Here we come to Lorenzo's point on moving ahead versus moving backwards. In the past, when we have made leap forwards in integration, I think an essential element has been political leadership. I think things will not come by themselves, because what we are talking about, for instance, on completing banking union, is to share core competence and core sovereignty at the national level. So this does not come all naturally, and I think it's quite normal that you have a pushback in these cases. But you will need, I think, strong political leadership to see that the capital invested in preserving the single currency, which was far from evident. I still remember that when in the midst of the crisis, observers predicted collapse within a week, or within 2 weeks. I was looking at the Financial Times ticking of the live coverage of the euro crisis as when you have a bank holdup. You have the robbers inside the bank, and then you have the CNN there outside looking at the. So that was the same type of coverage that we had in the sovereign debt crisis. The kind of investment that leaders have, policymakers have made into this is not something that can be thrown away, and it will not be thrown away.
Thank you, Marco. Paul, any last reaction, or you said your piece?
I'm satisfied.
Right, well, Marco told me earlier that he'd been discussing things with various journalists, and one aspect of what he said was criticized by the Italian newspapers, Il Corriere della Sera, and the other aspect was criticized by the Germans in Der Spiegel, so it proves he can never be right.
Or in Medium Stat Virtus.
Well, yes.
Which is the other way you're looking at it.
This is a bit of Latin I'm not going to accept. Sitting on the fence gives you a very sore backside, is the answer there. So I think that what Marco has demonstrated tonight is that he is able to analyze these problems from all sorts of perspectives. He's going to find opposition everywhere, and we see the opposition coming from all the critics of Brussels, and yet we have to find a way around it. And that maybe is the challenge that comes next. At the risk of advertising something I'm doing, there's a UK initiative called the UK in a Changing Europe, and as part of that, I will be producing a further economic explainer to try to make sense of what Marco has been saying. So do look for this coming out in the next 2 or 3 weeks. Thanks very much to everybody. Thanks to the panelists, and thank you all.